Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being here with us on another Sunday morning. Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, as we talk today about corruption and bribery in politics, our guest, Professor of Law at the University of Virginia, Mike Gilbert. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, welcome. I appreciate you being here with us. Professor Gilbert, Director for the Center of Public Law and Political Economy, also a member of the Democracy Initiative's Corruption Lab for Ethics, Accountability, and the Rule of Law, also known as the CLEAR Lab, directs UVA's Law Center for Public Law, Political Economy, has won UVA's All-University Teaching Award and the Student Council Distinguished Teaching Award. His current research focuses on campaign finance law, corruption, and the adjudication of culture war disputes. I asked you to come in today to talk about corruption and bribery in politics because it seems as though, regardless of which administration is in the White House, whatever level of politics we look at, there is always discussion about corruption and bribery. So the goal today is not to argue about, as you can always find an article, Trump's top 10 bribery issues or something similar that we've seen in the last year or so. But I want to start with bribery and corruption. Am I wrong about loyalty oaths and the personalizing of government? Is that in itself a form of corruption when you ask someone to follow me as your leader rather than the law, the Constitution, the rules of our city, state, or country?
Well, that is a great question, and it's a difficult one because the answer depends in part on one's definition of corruption. And it turns out that the definition of corruption is not straightforward. Different people look at different scenarios and situations, and some people see corruption, some people aren't sure, and other people see just the ordinary workings of the democratic process. So one way to think about whether it's corruption is just to ask whether a kind of loyalty oath along the lines of what you suggested constitutes bribery under, for example, federal bribery law. And the answer to that is almost certainly no. The main federal bribery statute is subject to interpretation, in part because the statute itself includes the word corruptly in it, and that term's not defined. But I think in general, people would not think of a loyalty oath as being corruption in the sense of constituting federal bribery or something like that. But moving away from criminal law and just thinking generally about corruption and about behavior that we would classify as corruption, I think a lot of reasonable people, and I might well put myself in this category, I'd think about it a little more, but we would say, yes, if the nature of the loyalty oath is to ask this or that official to put another official or person first, and obligations to the Constitution or to the law or to a constituency second, that feels to me like a kind of corruption and something that shouldn't be done. And as you say, we want to talk here generally about corruption. This is not a show that is as I understand it, we're not focusing today on President Trump or President Biden or whatever. But this issue did, it has become more salient in recent years.
But there are oaths that one takes when you take, when you step into office, correct? Whatever office you take, as to mayor or governor or president, are there not, does that oath not say, am I misunderstanding part of what you first answered, that the oath that you take doesn't say, I promise to be honest and lead the country, the state, or the city first above my own needs?
Well, that's a good question. I wish I had at the tip of my fingers the exact wording of the oath one takes upon becoming president. And even though I just saw Joe Biden repeat it not long ago, I don't remember the exact words of it. There are lots of different oaths. So if you just think about all the offices in this country, federal, state, local, many of them come with oaths. The exact wording of the oaths may vary by office and location. I certainly don't have a handle on all of those. I think a typical oath, including the one the president takes, is something along the lines of upholding the Constitution and protecting the country and things like that. So you're taking an oath for sure, and you could construe the broad language of the oath quite naturally to be a kind of oath to put country first. That seems exactly right to me. It's not obvious to me that if an official tries to extract from somebody else an oath to them personally, possibly at the expense of that oath to the country, look, that's a bad thing. You won't have any trouble convincing me of that. Is it corruption or a form of corruption? Maybe, but you're just going to get disagreement about that. People don't agree on what exactly constitutes corruption. Some people want to label any act that is a kind of, or that leads to a kind of misrepresentation of the public or its best interests as corruption, and other people have a more narrow conception of it. Let me say one more thing, if I may, too. Just to be clear about this, I don't take the position, I don't think most people take the position, that a certain kind of loyalty among government officials is important. As we've just discussed, of course, you should be loyal to the country and the Constitution. But also, if you think, for example, of a president or a governor, they have big jobs to do. And it'll be easier to do those jobs and do them well if you can delegate at least some responsibilities to others. And of course, that delegation is going to work better if the people to whom you delegate are people with whom you get along and whom you trust and who you think views and interests are aligned with yours. And if you think about that as a kind of loyalty, then loyalty, seeking loyalty among government officials isn't inherently bad. The problem comes in the kind of scenario you describe, where I'm an official, say, and I have, on the one hand, of course, a loyalty to the country and the Constitution, and then I'm being asked to take a different kind of loyalty oath that's going to be in conflict with that first one. That's where the problem arises, and that's where, you know, whatever you call it, corruption or not, we've got a problem.
Our guest today on Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call is Professor Mike Gilbert, University of Virginia Professor of Law, and a member of the CLEAR Lab at UVA, the Corruption Lab for Ethics, Accountability, and the Rule of Law. Professor, let's slide a little bit and discuss ethics. And maybe that's where some of this conversation about corruption needs to go, in terms of identifying and putting a definition on corruption and helping to understand, if it's not written down in a thesaurus that helps our leaders, then maybe we can figure it out this way. How are ethics relevant in politics today, or have we lost that?
Oh, a good question. It seems to me ethics are always relevant to politics. I think that has been true in the whole history of the United States, in the whole history of government. As soon as you assign the power to this or that official to make this or that a decision on behalf of the public, you raise the possibility of that person making the wrong decision, not necessarily just because of error or miscalculation. We all make mistakes sometimes, but because they're acting in their own interest or they're discounting the public's interest or whatever else. And so questions of corruption and therefore questions of ethics, I think, are just everywhere in government now and always. You asked if we've lost it. Yeah, that's such a tough question. It's easy to be cynical about politics. I myself follow politics pretty closely, and I try not to get dragged down by it, but sometimes I'll admit I do. People make decisions that it's easy to look at and say, you know, that's just seemingly self-evidently a bad, self-serving decision, which is a way of saying it's a kind of unethical decision. Is that problem worse today among government officials than it has been in the past and historically? Are we worse off now than we were, say, during the Watergate era? You know, I'm reluctant to make comparisons like that. It relies on a command of history that I'm just not confident I have well enough. It's hard to observe all these facts. I certainly share the view that there feels like a kind of ethics deficit. I'll say, too, there are really, when we talk about ethics in government or behavior by politicians, I think that two concepts sometimes get mixed up. One is the actual ethics themselves. Is this politician making a good decision or a bad decision, a just or an unjust one? But then there is an at least somewhat separate question about the appearance of ethics. So it is possible for a politician to make a decision that is actually ethical, that might well be in the public's interest, but that doesn't look that way. From the outside looking in, it looks quite unethical. And of course, it can go the other way too. Maybe the other way is more common. You make a decision that appears to be ethical, you certainly spin it that way, but it's actually unethical. And I think that distinction is quite important when we think about ethics and good behavior, because I just don't think it comes up nearly as often in private life as in public. I mean, we all make decisions in our private lives that have ethical implications, but usually, not always, but usually it's the ethics of it itself, or the ethics themselves, and not the appearance of it that we're worried about. In public life, with thousands or millions of voters and constituents watching, the appearances matter too. And that's something to think about. Trust in government matters, appearance matters. And it's not obvious to me that politicians always, or government officials generally, take that to heart.
Well, as we talk about ethics, the United States is built on religion and, in fact, Christianity, although it has altered a bit. Do you think that are our ethics and politics, do the political offices carry specific rules of ethics, or are they just culturally assigned rules of ethics?
I think the answer is both, if I understand what you mean by culturally assigned. So if, for example, you are a member of the Senate or the U.S. House of Representatives or something like that, you're not only subject to the usual slate of federal laws that tell you not to commit bribery and things like that, but you're also subject to a set of written rules of conduct that those chambers have imposed upon themselves and their own members. So the House has ethics rules and the Senate does too. And they're written down and they're subject to interpretation, and you can be investigated for violating them, and you can even get in some trouble if you do. So those rules apply at the federal level to many actors, and some states have versions of these rules too. you talked about, I forget your exact phrasing, kind of cultural ethics or cultural norms. I could be mistaken, but what I think you mean there is a kind of rule of conduct or a norm that isn't actually written down, but that as political actors or government officials, you're expected to follow, and that you do, or you're supposed to, just as a matter of course. And I think, yes, there are those norms. There absolutely are those norms. And the last several years have drawn attention to them, and specifically drawn attention to the fact that they are, in fact, just informal norms. There's no enforcement mechanism. So if I can just draw out one specific example that's relevant, has been relevant over recent years and might well be relevant in the future. Since Nixon's administration, it has been a norm for candidates for the presidency and for sitting presidents to release their tax records for the public to see, for journalists to pore over, and so on. There's no law requiring this. There's no, to the best of my knowledge, there's no written ethical rule anywhere requiring this. It's just been an informal norm that it turns out all of these candidates and presidents have followed for decades. When Donald Trump became a candidate for the presidency, he violated that norm. He didn't share his tax records. He still hasn't. And a lot of people were upset by that, and they couldn't believe he could do that. Well, he could, because it's just this informal thing. He is within his rights to withhold that information. And there are other examples of this kind of thing, too, where we have, perhaps without realizing it, been relying more than we might know on a set of informal, unenforceable norms. And they work when people follow them. But in fact, there's nothing making people follow them, and that can lead to controversy. It can undermine trust. It can change politics as usual, and maybe for the worse.
Well, and I often wonder if I am using the proper word here when you talk about ethics versus morals, and you get into behavior, etc. But when we start talking about politics and what role ethics might play in as the first step in corruption and bribery, in today's politics, and you'd have to tell me in a historical nature whether this existed 20 years ago or 40 years ago or 100 years ago. But in today's politics, you still see our representatives on a federal level go to work well-dressed. But you don't see all of the representatives speak well of the other. If they have a problem in the past, they might have said something sharp or blunt to make their point. But now they say something rude or demeaning, and that is different, and whether or not that leads somewhere in our, is a change in our behavior, I don't know. Let's come back to that, though, and see where it takes us in a conversation with Professor Michael Gilbert. He's a professor of law at UVA, also a member of the CLEAR Lab, the Corruption Lab for Ethics, Accountability, and the Rule of Law. We'll take a break and be right back. And welcome back here, Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, with our guest discussing corruption and bribery in politics. Today, Michael Gilbert, Professor of Law at UVA. Professor, so I had mentioned where ethics stood with corruption and bribery and sort of how things were and had changed, or had they changed from current events to 20 or 40 or 100 years ago. Can you talk about that a bit?
Well, yeah, I'll take a stab at it. Maybe I'll first pick up on this question of kind of decorum and vitriol in politics. So I believe that there has always been sharp language in politics. And, you know, there was no kind of golden age when everyone in Washington or in state capitals or whatever was polite and respectable to one another. There have always been sharp elbows. But I do have a sense, I think many, many people share this sense, that things have gotten worse, particularly in Washington, over recent years, maybe the last couple decades, something like that. You certainly get the strong sense that in public, people just don't treat each other well. They use sharp language, and they're not very respectful of one another, and they treat each other like enemies rather than, or at least they sometimes do, rather than treating each other as fellow Americans who have many interests in common, but some disagreements. And I think that, you know, what is this attributable to? God, this is hard, right? Causation is hard. Society's complicated. Why do we behave this way now when we maybe didn't do it before? I don't have a clear answer to that. I have a speculation, which I'm not alone in thinking, which is that part of the problem has to do with the 24-hour news cycle. There are more opportunities for politicians to be public-facing, whether it's on TV or the internet or social media, whatever, and perhaps comparatively fewer opportunities for them to be in private with their colleagues, including their colleagues off the aisle. And it's a kind of two-hat game in Washington when you're or might be in front of your constituents and interest groups. You have to talk tough, and you can only be reasonable and compromising behind the scenes, and there aren't as many times behind the scenes. I think this is a problem. Cooperation in life is good, and that's true in politics, too. That compromise in politics should not be a bad word. It's how democracy is supposed to function, in my view. I think that's not an uncommon view, and too many politicians today seem to disregard that. At least in their public statements.
So where do ethics take us in terms of corruption and bribery? Can you have good ethics in your mind and still do corrupt things? Or if you're doing something that's corrupt, do you know or that you're ethics aren't that good, or do you not think about your ethics?
This is a great question, and it is right now a very important question, perhaps more important than usual for lawyers and scholars and other people who are interested in thinking about these things. So I'll just use Donald Trump as an example, but he wouldn't be the only one who we could use. As you know, as everybody listening knows, when he was president, and even now after the fact, he's made a lot of claims about the election having been stolen from him. And he's even made some calls to government officials, including the Secretary of State in Georgia and so on. The transcript of those calls can be read to suggest that he really wanted those officials to overturn the results. And you might think straight away, this looks like a kind of corrupt act, a subversion of democracy. But here's the tricky question for lawyers and for judges. Suppose that Donald Trump believed sincerely, and therefore had no criminal intent, that he actually won. I think he's wrong about that. I think the evidence is quite clear. But suppose he believed that. Can he be convicted of corruption? So the usual answer is no. To violate a criminal law, you need mens rea. You need a kind of, which is the fancy term for a kind of criminal intent. And if he sincerely believes he's in the right and he's trying to do what justice requires, then maybe there's no mens rea there. But of course, that creates a real puzzle and a real problem for the law. It means that even if you're wrong on the facts, even if you are deluded in some way, even if you're doing things that in fact threaten to undermine an electoral process or whatever else, you can't get in trouble for them as long as you sincerely believe you're in the right. And that just doesn't seem, that doesn't seem like a good thing. We don't want to encourage people to kind of clear their minds and then with impunity do bad acts. So your question is a really good one. And it's a, it, there's an open question in the law here, how this works and how it should work.
Well, so what I'm hearing is that the judicial branch's ethics, or is that their step into ethics, their form of judgment on ethics?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, you could construe it that way. I don't think that's how judges would describe what they're up to in cases that implicate bribery and the federal bribery statute and things like that. I think what judges would say is, look, we're just reading the language of the statute and we're trying to do what we're supposed to do, which is figure out what it means. What we're not trying to do, what we're not supposed to do, is just inject into that language our own personal views. Judges are supposed to find the law. They're not supposed to make the law. That's the theory. It doesn't always hold up so well in practice, but that's the theory. So what I think the judges would say is something like, we're just trying to make the best sense of these statutes that we can. But the statutes, as written, leave some of these questions open. So as I mentioned earlier, the main federal bribery statute, it doesn't forbid quid pro quos. For example, I do a favor for you, the politician, and in exchange you give me a vote. That's not how it's written. It forbids, quote, corrupt quid pro quos. Well, what does the term corrupt mean? It's open to question. That's the language of the statute. Judges try to figure it out. You get different interpretations depending on which court you're in. And, you know, there's looseness in the joints here. And I would just say, this is not entirely or even largely a problem of the courts making or Congress is making because it drafted the statute this way. There really is a tricky problem here. I mean, there are some actions that a politician or government official might take that everybody, regardless, just about everybody, regardless of their political views, is going to look at and say, that's corruption, that's bribery, that should be forbidden. And courts and jurors might, you know, draw the same conclusion. If I give you a bag of cash in exchange for your vote on my defense contract, just about everybody's going to agree that's bribery, that's corruption. But there are many cases in the gray area, right? So if, for example, a bunch of union members support a particular politician with lawful campaign contributions, and then that politician votes to enact a bill that in one way or another supports or benefits those union members, some people are going to look at that and say that's corruption, that's a quid pro quo. But other people are going to look at that same scenario and say that's democracy in action. That's a representative responding to his or her constituents. That's what democracy is supposed to be. So this is a tricky issue. The line between corrupt quid pro quos and political responsiveness to constituents is not a fine one. So efforts to capture that line with the law, efforts by courts to interpret that law and make sense of that line, they're messy. It's a real challenge. This should not detract us from the easy cases where everyone agrees it's corrupt, and those cases do arise, and we should be vigilant to reduce them, to deter them. But it does mean there's this gray area where we're not sure what to do. Courts aren't sure what to do. Legislators who draft these statutes aren't sure what to do.
Well, you've also, if I'm not mistaken, you've also written about, let's see if I can find it here. Is this your quote? Transparency in government causes the very corruption it aims to prevent?
Yes, that's my quote.
Yeah. So can you talk about that? Because people often say that we need more transparency to prevent corruption.
Yeah. So that is my quote, although taken out of context, it makes it sound like I'm taking a stronger position than I am. So
I'm great at taking things out of context. My wife would tell you that.
Well, I assume no ill intent, but just to be clear, so I've been interested for some time in the relationship between transparency in government and corruption. And as you say, the conventional wisdom is very much that transparency deters corruption, that it's a kind of antidote for these problems. The old phrase is, you know, sunlight's the best disinfectant. And here's where I'm qualifying the quote you gave of mine earlier. I do not hold the view that transparency never deters corruption, or that transparency is a bad idea. That's not my view at all. But I do have the view that sometimes, when the stars align just right, the same transparency that we think deters corruption can actually cause it. So on the one hand, transparency helps some of the time, but in fact, sometimes, might be rare, but sometimes it actually causes it. And the general point being, it's not a magic bullet. It might help, it might frequently help, it doesn't always help. If we're worried about corruption in government, we can't just rely on transparency. And if I may, can I sort of explain the argument so everybody sees it?
Yes, please. I'm curious as to how, as to when it doesn't help.
Yeah. Well, let me start with an anecdote, actually, that'll kind of demonstrate the point, and then I'll generalize from it. So some years ago, a member of Congress, Eleanor Holmes Norton, she called a lobbyist and she left a voicemail. And you can still go on the internet and listen to this voicemail. And the gist of the voicemail was this. She says to this lobbyist, "You and your clients have business in front of a committee that I'm on in Congress. It's a powerful committee. And I couldn't help but notice that you, the lobbyist, have made contributions to other members of this committee, but you haven't made a campaign contribution to me." And I think the language she used was that she was frankly surprised by that. Now, the lobbyist publicized this voicemail, and it got a lot of attention. And I want to be clear, I'm not accusing the congresswoman of committing a crime or anything like that, though some people who heard that voicemail thought it does sound a little like extortion. Well, here's the question that I got interested in when I heard about this. How did the congresswoman know that this particular lobbyist had given to other members of the committee, but not her? And it seems to me there's more than one potential explanation, but a very natural explanation, especially with respect to contributions who went to politicians not in her party, was, well, she checked the campaign finance records. She checked the records produced by these transparency laws that are supposed to make government better, make it clean. And what she saw was, well, this lobbyist has helped others, but not me. And that teed up this phone call that, again, some people look at and say, that's a kind of extortion. Okay, so here's the general point. Transparency laws provide information, and they make it public. And that information can help journalists, it can help law enforcement find and deter corruption, and that's good. But at exactly the same time, exactly that same information can also help exactly the actors about whom we worry. It kind of feeds information to these markets. So if you think about bribery, bribery is an exchange. So let's make it concrete. Suppose that I'm a, you know, corrupt defense contractor and I want to buy a senator's vote. Well, I'm trying to execute an exchange. I will give a senator some money, say, and in exchange that senator will give me a vote. It's a kind of transaction. Now, if you just think about the steps that are necessary to execute that transaction, it's tricky. I first need to find a senator who I think might be corruptible. If I ask the wrong senator, I could be accused of attempted bribery. So the stakes here are high. And once I identify a senator I think I can corrupt, now I need to figure out the price. What do I have to do for you? How much do I have to give you? And then after all that's done, we need to trust each other. You can't sign a contract for an illegal exchange, money for votes. So for this exchange to happen, we have to trust each other. I have to trust that if I give the senator the money today, he or she will deliver the vote on my defense contract tomorrow or in a month or whatever. Now, if you just think about campaign finance records, they can actually facilitate every step in this process. How am I going to find a senator who I think might be corruptible? Well, the campaign finance records identify for me a bunch of senators who the defense industry already gives to. So at least as a first step, I know these are people who might be sympathetic to my industry. How much money do I have to pay to be in the senator's good graces? Well, here's a record that's telling me how much other interest groups and people and so on give to this senator. It's not quite a menu with prices, but it gives me some information about what it takes. And then the last step is trust. Remember, this bribe, this illegal exchange only goes through if each side trusts the other. How can I trust the senator? He says he'll vote my way, but who knows? He could just take the money and run. Well, if the campaign finance records reveal a bunch of interest groups giving to the same senator over a long period, that's evidence that you can trust this senator. I mean, if he or she was reneging on these interest groups, they wouldn't keep paying him. They wouldn't keep making contributions. So these campaign finance records that on the one hand can help law enforcement root out and deter corruption, at exactly the same time they can feed information to this market. And that's the point I try to make in some research of mine. Transparency can be a kind of double-edged sword. And I should say, too, this effect is not limited just to bribery. That's the scenario I focus on. I'm especially interested in campaign finance. But versions of this same issue crop up in many settings. So I'll just give you another example or two quickly so people see it. In general, courthouses in the U.S. are open. If a journalist or a member of the public wants to go see somebody's trial, you can walk into court and watch. And, of course, that kind of transparency is good in many ways. It gives us faith in the court system. It lets us kind of monitor these prosecutors and the judges. It's good for the integrity of our system in a lot of ways. But, of course, it does have this downside. Exactly that same openness, that same transparency allows a mobster to sit in the front row and intimidate a witness or something like that. Okay, here's another version of the problem. Quite different setting, but it's the same kind of idea. I don't know if this program still operates, but for a while in the city of Baltimore, people were dying from drug overdoses. They were trying to use drugs like heroin or cocaine or something, and they were accidentally using fentanyl, which is much more powerful, and it was killing people. It's terrible. A service was introduced whereby you could get a text alert. If there were a bunch of overdoses in a particular corner of the city, you'd get a text alert telling you to avoid that corner. If you're in the market for drugs, there's fentanyl there, and it's killing people, and you should stay away. Well, that's a kind of transparency measure. And, of course, it's good in a way. If you don't want fentanyl, now you know where not to go. But it has this double-edged sword aspect to it. Some people do want fentanyl. And what's the effect of this pushing information out to the public? Well, for people who want fentanyl, now they know where to go. And this is consistent with my kind of general interest in this. Transparency is double-sided. It feeds information to law enforcement, to the public that's helpful, but at exactly the same time, it can juice these illegal markets.
That's amazing. Again, our guest today is law professor Mike Gilbert from the CLEAR Lab, Lab for Ethics, Accountability, and the Rule of Law. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back. And thanks for being with us here again on another fabulous Sunday. And thanks to the Wren for letting us be here another week. Our guest, again, as we talk about ethics and corruption and bribery and politics, is UVA Professor Mike Gilbert. Professor, we were talking about transparency, but one of the issues that's happened over the last, and you'd have to give me the proper information, over the last decade has to do with super PACs and dark money. Can you take off on that and share with us your thoughts and the true info?
Sure, I'll take a stab at it. So your timing is just right. Super PACs are about 10 years old. They're a creation of the Federal Election Commission, in a sense, but they actually follow quite straightforwardly from a couple of opinions, most importantly, the decision by the U.S. Supreme Court called Citizens United. That's one of these rare Supreme Court cases that actually gets quite a lot of attention in the public and sticks in people's minds and I think remains controversial to this day. The gist of that case was as follows. The First Amendment to the Constitution gives not only natural persons, but also corporations, including for-profit corporations, an unlimited right to engage in a certain kind of political spending. So the Apple Corporation, just to pick an example, in the next election, if they want to open up their company treasury and spend $2 billion to support or oppose Joe Biden, they can do it. Now, they can't give that money to his campaign. That's a contribution. They can't do that. But if they want to run ads supporting or opposing Biden, Citizens United says they have a First Amendment right to do it. Well, that reasoning leads to the creation of super PACs. These are political action committees. The only thing they do is run the kinds of ads I've just been referring to. So they can't make contributions. They can't give 10 cents to Joe Biden's campaign or Donald Trump's campaign or whatever. They just run these ads and independently. Because that's all they do, and because the court in Citizens United said you can't place any limit on that, well, they can raise unlimited funds. So the Apple Corporation could spend a few billion dollars itself, or it could give a few billion dollars, far, far, far more than, you know, just about any ordinary citizen is in a position to give to a super PAC. And then the super PAC can take all that money and spend it on political ads and so on. The issue of dark money is connected to this. So that's a kind of general and pejorative phrase to refer to this kind of political spending where its sources, that is the sources of the money, can't be traced. And it comes up in different forms. I mean, it can be that the super PAC, following the law, releases to the Federal Election Commission a list of the people or entities that have made contributions to it. But that list might include some entities that are just, you know, kind of corporate shells, basically. It's just a name, you know, the Make America Great organization or whatever it is. And, of course, that doesn't really tell you who's behind the money. And this comes up in other ways, too. So if you want to spend in politics, you can form a super PAC or you can form a 501c, which is a kind of nonprofit organization. And the rules here get complicated and they implicate tax law and so on. But the basic idea is if you form one of these 501c's and you only spend some of your money, less than half, to be safe, on politics, including these kinds of ads, well, now you don't have to disclose anything at all. You're not a political committee. So you're not subject to disclosure. And, of course, this makes a lot of people nervous, and I understand that. You want to know who or what is spending millions or tens of millions in politics, and you can't find out. You just see, as I said, very general names, you know, the Freedom for America PAC or the America is the Best group. You know, you want to know who's behind the money, and right now our disclosure laws don't require that information to be made public.
So as we talk about corruption and bribery and ethics, and doing my homework, again, our guest today, Professor Mike Gilbert from UVA, you can pull up an awful lot of names in the history books when you go looking. So I picked out a handful here. So there's Rod Blagojevich, the Illinois governor who was impeached by his state general assembly because he was trying to sell the former senator Barack Obama's vacant seat for personal financial benefits. Chris Christie, the Republican New Jersey governor for what's known as Bridgegate, where he intentionally caused traffic jams at the George Washington Bridge because he was having problems with the state of New York. Roy Blanton, Democrat Tennessee governor, was extorting liquor licenses and taking a 30% profits kickback. David Hall, Oklahoma governor. He was charged with racketeering and extortion to sway investments toward a state retirement fund. Don Siegelman, Alabama governor. He sold a seat in the Alabama Health Board to provider HealthSouth founder for $500,000 and donations to his campaign. And then, of course, for those who may remember, Virginia Governor McDonnell sentenced to 2 years in prison for soliciting and obtaining payments and gifts and loans from a company called Star Scientific. So, and that we haven't even gotten to others. Many people, probably a little older, who are listening may remember Abscam. So it's just, is there something, is it the person or the position that brings about bribery and corruption?
Well, I think if you're, first of all, these are all great examples of people who have actually been caught doing things and prosecuted in one way or another, at least in a few of the cases you mentioned, particularly the recent ones, McDonald, Blagojevich, Christie. These have led to really interesting court cases where courts have had to grapple with some of these problems we got at before. Where's the line between democratic responsiveness or efforts to be responsive versus just plain old corruption? And we can talk about those cases if you're interested. On your specific question, I think that if you are a high-ranking government official, if you're a member of Congress, if you're a governor, of course, if you're the president, you have the power to do all kinds of things that can benefit or enrich all kinds of people. So just by running for and winning an office, you put yourself in a position where you're going to have to make these choices, or where the choices will be presented to you. And, you know, we have a kind of two-track, at least two-track system for trying to steer these officials to make the right decision. And the one track is the law. We've talked about this some already. It forbids bribery. It forbids extortion. It forbids racketeering. And in a lot of cases, just the threat of being punished for those things, you know, keeps people in the clear, I think. But not always. I mean, the law only works insofar as we can observe and catch you. And often we can't observe and catch you. People are doing things behind the scenes. You referred to the Abscam scandal, which predates me a little, but I know something about it. And it was controversial and shocking in part because I believe it was the first time that anyone had filmed sitting members of Congress taking bribes. And we can actually see what's happening. You know, often we can't. So, okay, so one track is the criminal law and related ethics rules and things we talked about, and that works to some degree, but not perfectly. The other track is we're just counting on people to behave in the right fashion, to do their public duty. And, you know, does that work very well? I think sometimes. I think given how politics operates, it's surprising how many, or at least it may be surprising how many people in positions of power are also trustworthy, well-meaning, public-minded people. But of course, they're not all that way. Our filters don't work perfectly. It is possible to get elected. And maybe some especially cynical people might say it's probable that if you're elected, you're not that kind of person. I mean, if you just think about what it takes to run for office, to raise the money you need, especially as, say, a freshman member of Congress or something, to run for re-election, the things you have to put yourself and your family through, you know, a lot of well-meaning, upright people, they don't want to do that. The job isn't attractive for people with the morals we want. So the second track is really important, and I'm not sure it always works very well or works very well at all. And as we talked about earlier, corruption's endemic to government. You can try to minimize it, but I don't know that any government ever has eliminated it.
Can you talk about, as we run low on time left in the program today, can you talk about profiting off the presidency? because while a lot of the folks who I mentioned last were governors or representatives, Abscam was six members of the House of Representatives because they were filmed by a fictitious Arabian company, a convicted con man, et cetera. The emoluments clause is about, talk about that with President Trump, please.
Yeah, so the federal constitution has actually a pair of emoluments clauses, and they're in the original constitution. They've been with us for over 200 years in very kind of brief form. The first one says that no person holding federal office, that's widely understood to include the president, can, unless Congress consents, accept presents or emoluments from a foreign state. And then we've got another provision in the Constitution, again, over 200 years old, that applies specifically to the president, and it basically says the president can't accept, beyond the compensation for the job, any emoluments from the federal government or from any state. So that second one is basically saying the president gets the salary that's set and that's that. No, the federal government or states, they can't pay any bonuses. So the emoluments clause has been, these clauses have been with us for over 200 years. In fact, they've never really been tested in court. So what is an emolument? What does this mean? That isn't exactly a term that's commonly used by English speakers today. That question, what does it mean, is the kind of question that we count on courts to answer when they get cases about the Constitution. They have to figure it out. And in fact, there are no court cases on this in all this time. We thought that might change, people who watch this sort of thing during Donald Trump's presidency, because as you know, as pretty much everybody knows, this goes back to our informal norms conversation from earlier, he did something that prior presidents and other office holders haven't done. He maintained his stake in his businesses while he was president. He put a little distance between himself and them, but I think not so much. So even as he's occupying the White House, he has golf clubs and restaurants and hotels and people, including foreign officials, lobbyists, and so on. They're staying in these things or using these facilities. And so at least indirectly, he's profiting from them through his business. And this led to some court cases where the claim was that Donald Trump is in violation of these emoluments clauses, specifically the first one. That's the one I paid attention to anyway. The claim is that when all these foreign officials are staying at his club in Florida, that's in violation of the Constitution. Like I said, we don't know what an emolument is. The courts never told us. There are two kind of prevailing theories of this. Maybe they're obvious what they are. I'm not sure. So one theory says something like this. The word emolument means something like, you know, salary or compensation. So if that's what emolument means, then it sure looks like he wasn't in violation of it. Staying at his hotel isn't the same thing as paying him a salary. There's another view which says something much broader. An emolument is just like profit, right? Are you profiting? Are you benefiting? It's some benefit that accrues to you, including a benefit through an ordinary market transaction, like when someone stays in your hotel and you make a little money. If that's what emolument means, then Donald Trump was in violation of the Constitution, or seems to have been, for all 4 years of his presidency. So we had some cases on this, and they were working their way up. And then just a couple of months back, the Supreme Court got them, and it dismissed these cases as moot. So that's the court's way of basically saying, we're not going to decide what an emolument is and whether the president was in violation of this right now. We don't need to, because he's not the president anymore. So the issue has gone away. And maybe that's not a surprising decision. It would be, or at least it could be, quite politically volatile for the Supreme Court of the United States to say something like, you know, Donald Trump violated the Constitution for four straight years. Maybe these kinds of considerations explain why the court took a pass on that one. But of course, it just perpetuates this problem. We still don't know what an emolument is. And depending on how our politics develop in the years ahead, and specifically whether Donald Trump makes a comeback, you know, the question could come right back up.
So, Professor, we have about 2 minutes left. Every president does something with presidential pardons, especially near the end of their term. Many people would say that they do it in a somewhat corrupt manner, helping friends beyond the way. Others, not just President Trump, who was the most recent president with an end of term, every president in recent memory. Can you speak briefly on that?
If so, the Constitution gives the president the pardon power. The Supreme Court, they have interpreted this piece of the Constitution, and they've basically said it's a kind of wide open power, by which I mean if Congress, for example, wanted to limit the power, they really can't. The president just has plenary power in this space. And as you say, presidents use it, not with the same frequency. President Obama used it a lot. President Trump, I don't have the numbers in front of me, he used it, I think, not as much, but a fair amount. President Bush used it much less. There are always allegations of corruption in this space. Well, let me say, I think for all these presidents, most of their pardons don't have this kind of taint. They're under the radar kind of pardons. It's somebody here or there who's facing life in prison for a nonviolent crime, and the president says, let's let him off. But some of the pardons do raise this question of corruption. So, you know, President Trump, most recently, he pardoned pretty close allies, Roger Stone and Steve Bannon and Paul Manafort. Two of those three were convicted by federal juries of violating federal law. And he just let them off. And a lot of people think, you know, that doesn't look so good. But this is our system. You can't get rid of that pardon power without a constitutional amendment. That's really hard to do. And let me just say one other thing, too. You know, the pardon power can be used for good. So if you look back historically, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, they used the pardon power to pardon insurrectionists, right? So Lincoln pardoned people who were members of the Confederate Army but defected to the North. That was a way to encourage them to defect. If your country is really in turmoil, pardoning a bunch of people can be a way to knit things back together. So it's not like there can't be any justification for this. But there isn't always a justification. It can be used for problematic ends.
Professor, thank you so much for joining us today. Professor Mike Gilbert, professor of law at UVA and a member of Democracy Initiative's CLEAR Lab, the Corruption Lab for Ethics, Accountability, and the Rule of Law. Professor, I hope you'll join us again in the future.
It'd be my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. See you again next week as we talk about the history of UVA's pep band. See you then.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.